Hello and welcome to this episode of You Seem Interesting. I'm your host, Danny Rouillet, and you guys are the best. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. It is an honor to be beamed to your cell phone as we lay in wait for you to decide maybe one day to push play. If you're checking us out on Patreon, you're the best. You're the mostest bestest, and you know it. Patreon.com/FunnyDanny for all of that jazz. You could support the show. That is really cool. This week's episode is about dermatology. I know that's probably not that exciting to a lot of you. And if you're here already and you haven't decided, I'm just going to go ahead and skip to the next one or wait for next week's, I get it. But if you've listened to this show at all, first of all, thank you. Second of all, you're probably starting to get an idea of how my weird brain works. The idea for this show was to do this, right? Was to go into topics that aren't always on the forefront of our minds, right? I mean, I've had some really cool guests on. Obviously, I've had a television news personality, Mary Bruce. I had the former national counterterrorism director on. Those kind of topics are big and obvious and easy and very visual to us, right? We can see those things. But I've also had a brewmaster on, an FBI special agent that tracks down some dangerous fugitives, things like that that are going on in our society, right under our noses, that we may not see. We may not fully comprehend what's happening. I love learning about those kinds of topics. So my guest this week is Dr. Terrence Keeney, buddy of mine, someone that I went to high school with, grew up with, really smart dude, great guy, was a college athlete. And at no time while we were growing up, and at no time while he was playing lacrosse at Duke, did I think, that guy's probably going to take care of people's skin. I never once thought that, right? And I don't know that he did either. He's got a great story about his journey, how he ended up where he was. But we're going to go behind the scenes, a little bit of detail coming up here in a moment. But before we do, it's time for the strangest gimmick in all of podcasting.
It is once again time for the strangest gimmick in all of podcasting. A moderately passable celebrity impression asking you for money.
Okay, Stephen A. Smith here. Let's be real, what we talking about. It's preposterous. It's a Hyundai Elantra. It's ridiculous. It's absolute travesty. It's a sham. It's a mockery. It's a travesty mockery of the highest order. Let's be real here. What are we talking about? You go to patreon.com/funnydanny. That's a website. Okay, you can contribute to the show. Support this man and support this show. That's real. Thank you very much, Stephen A. Smith. Wow, that is very nice to get that kind of ringing endorsement from a hot take machine that has a television show that very few people watch. Tens of people watch it. Let's talk nitty gritty here, okay? When we get to the world of dermatology, we got to talk what happens to the skin. Skin cancer is the most common form of cancer in the United States and worldwide. Some of these numbers really jumped out at me. I found them jarring. 1 in 5 Americans will develop skin cancer by the age of 70. More than 2 people die of skin cancer in the U.S. every hour, and having 5 or more sunburns, that's it. 5 or more sunburns in your life doubles your risk for melanoma. I mean, that's shocking, those kinds of numbers, right? In the U.S., more than 9,500 people are diagnosed with skin cancer every single day. The annual cost of treating skin cancers in the U.S. is estimated at $8.1 billion and about $4.8 billion for non-melanoma skin cancers and $3.3 billion for melanoma. So, non-melanoma skin cancer. I know, we're getting to the nitty-gritty here, so bear with me. Some nuts and bolts, some information. There's a number of different kinds. There's basal, I'm not sure which one it is, cell carcinoma. Okay, that's probably the most common type of skin cancer. And in the layers of skin, you might see a waxy bump, a pink patch, an open sore, a scar, elevated growth with some rolled edges, and a growth that crusts, itches, oozes, bleeds, that kind of a thing, right? Uncomfortable stuff to think about, very, very, very squeamish. A squamous cell carcinoma, SCC, that's a red patch that develops, thickened patch of skin, a wart, raised growth with a depression. Then there's Merkel cell carcinoma, and then we get into melanoma skin kind of cancer, okay? Those are the moles that people famously say, hey, that's a mole, that's new, you should get that checked out. That's that one. So there's a number of different types of cancers. And the basic thing is this. If you are exposed in excess to sunlight, if you don't take care of your skin, your risk goes up each and every time. So if you're only outside for a few minutes, get a little vitamin D, you get in your car, it's not a big deal. But if you're outside with extended exposure to sunlight, to UV radiation over days, weeks, months, years, your risk of skin cancer increases dramatically. We don't think of it, right? We never think about that sort of thing. It's much easier to sort of say, hey, if I eat this, I'll get fat. but it's worth the risk and trade-off in that moment, right? But each time you're doing something that's risky behavior, like a tanning bed, for example, it is a gong show. That's like one of the worst things you can do for your body. In fact, tanning beds are illegal for people under 18 in a number of states and municipalities, including the District of Columbia. I think it's 18 or 19 different places. You can't do it without parents' permission. And it's horrible for you, basically. You're exposing yourself to cancer-causing agents. You're exposing yourself to cancer-causing agents. The International Agency for Research on Cancer, an affiliate of the World Health Organization, includes ultraviolet light and ultraviolet tanning devices in group one. And what that means, group one includes agents like plutonium, cigarettes, like some of the worst carcinogens available to us are in those tanning beds. So in no uncertain terms, do not do tanning beds. Okay, if you're going to the Jersey Shore, figure out something else. You can't do it. It's awful for you. Please, please, please don't do it. So this is kind of a jarring number here. This is the last nuts and bolts number I'll give you. In the past decade, from 2010 to 2020, the number of new invasive melanoma cases diagnosed annually increased by 47%. The last 10 years, cases have gone up by 47%. That is a bad number. That's shocking. And that speaks to our behavior. So without further ado, I want to get into my guest and we'll talk about a little bit more in terms of some of the data and the wide range. This is one of the things I'm fascinated by when it comes to dermatology. Everything from these sorts of life-saving type procedures, these let's take care of ourselves, very, very critical and important, all the way to the frankly trivial. Right? Terrence and I talk about all of it. For example, I got bags under my eyes. That's way less of a concern than some of these things that I just mentioned. But that's kind of the cool thing about dermatology is they do everything under the sun. Terrible pun by me. But please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Terrence Keenan. Haven't caught up with my guest this week on UC Interesting in a long time, so it's a nice excuse to talk to my pal, Dr. Terrence Keenan. Terrence, what's up, man?
How's it going, Danny? Great to be on the show.
I appreciate it, man. Yeah, it's going well. So you are a dermatologist. What don't people know about dermatology? What do they think it is? And what are some of the things that they find out? Really, you do that too?
Yes. Yeah, so as a dermatologist, we are the doctors of the skin, and the skin's the largest organ of our body. So everyone thinks acne and the one little skin disorder they had as in their lifetime, which are a lot and very common, like acne, warts. But there's over 2,000 dermatologic diseases, and our specialty is beyond just skin, since hair is an appendage of the skin. So we treat hair disorders as well as nail disorders. So it's a much bigger field than people realize. And it's one of the most common, complaints or visits to the doctor. Actually, in primary care, 40% of all primary care visits are dermatology disorders. So it's common. It's bigger than people realize. And it's interesting to me because it's, if you like, with a lot of medicine, you're looking at scans and not really seeing the problem with dermatology. Your skin's right in front of you, so you can really visualize it and treat and go from there.
When did you decide that was going to be your focus? Like when you're playing lacrosse at Duke as an undergrad, you catch a pass at a practice, and you're like, you know what? It's dermatology for me. That's what's going to happen. Like when was that kind of eureka moment that you said, this is what I want to do?
No, my route to dermatology was not the classic route. So if you're a med student listening, I did not take the regular path. So a lot of people who go to medical school, they have a career in mind. And it's usually, especially they've had exposure to. So as an athlete, a college athlete, I had been around orthopedic surgeons for a long time. So I went to med school. I was like, I'm going to be an orthopedic surgeon and went through the whole, really kind of dove into it. So during med school, I did research and spent a summer up in New York at Hospital Special Surgery, a big research institute was doing. Relevant to you, Danny, I was doing research on Tommy John surgeries and really thought that that's the route I was going to take. And during, especially you actually do rotations. And when I was in these cases, these surgeries, I enjoyed it, but I didn't love it. It wasn't like, God, that's awesome. I want to do that 20 hours a day, 6 days a week. Like a lot of surgeons do, you work a lot. And I kept having this like kind of bug in the back of my ear being like, is this really what I want to do, for the rest of my life? Because in medicine, it's different than a lot of specialties is you got to kind of pick your career. And this was my really your third year of med school. So I'm 26, and literally you're picking your future for the rest of your life. And it's really hard to change it once you picked a specialty. So, you know, for me, I kind of had this like panic right when my applications were due. I was actually lined up to go back down to Duke to do my training. I had a good relationship with the department there, and they're, you know, they weren't supposed to say it, but I had kind of a spot lined up there. And I remember turning to my now wife, we were just dating at the time. And I woke up one morning, I was like, I don't want to be an orthopedic surgeon. She goes, what are you going to do? And I was like, I have no idea. My wow. fourth year of med school. Yeah. So that was like, and it was like really scary. People, my parents were like up in arms. My teachers at school were like, because it was really late to decide, like, because I had all my eggs in one basket. I was an orthopedic surgeon all the way. And then when I decided, I liked it, but I didn't love it, and I couldn't commit to a career of it, I had no backup plan. I had no idea what I wanted to do. And so this was my fourth year of med school. So I a lot of my friends were in finance. I was like, maybe I should just graduate med school and go become a consultant or investment banker. So my last year of med school, I was finishing my requirements, but I was interviewing for finance jobs. I was going to leave medicine. And this was 6 months before the financial crisis. This is like 2007. Yeah. And I'm interviewing at Goldman and Morgan Stanley and McKinsey and Boston. So these finance groups, I mean, on the healthcare side. So
right. Sure.
Yeah. There are a lot of doctors who end up doing that. And it was interesting from a, you know, macro level at these top end guys, you know, like, yeah, they're like setting up the healthcare system in Sri Lanka. They're like, you know, counseling, you know, the IPOs of these new biotech companies, but not everyone gets to that point. And I was like, oh, I want to do that. And it's like a kid saying, you want to be president. It's like, not, you know, like very few people get to that top tier. So I was just doing rotations in med school to finish my med school career at UVA. And it's funny how your life changes on who you meet. The chairman of the department was this Southern guy, like named Kenneth Greer. He's like a famous dermatologist, but he's like a Southern guy, wore leather, rode my motorcycle to Charlotte, you know, like around Charlottesville. He's like a great guy. And I did a rotation, not just doing it to finish my requirements. And we hit it off, and he was like, his job was like, I'm going to convince you to become a dermatologist. And so he really kind of showed me kind of the breadth of what you can do. Cause the way medicine has kind of evolved is everyone becomes an expert, you know, like a very niche expert. Mm-hmm. And you see this probably in sports, you know, where if an athlete, you know, breaks his right ring finger, there's like one right ring finger broken surgeon you go to. If you have Tommy John, you go to this guy. If you have shoulders, you go over here. And because all they do is shoulders, all they do is, you know, the Tommy John surgery, and they get really good at it because it's repetition. To me, that was boring to me. I was like, I just don't want to just do the same surgery on different people all day long. So I get bored easily. So in dermatology, there's and the way the specialty is you can't really kind of subspecialize that well unless you're in an academic department. So most dermatologists have this broad range of things that they see. So in my current practice, I have a medical dermatology wing where we'll see the rashes, the acne, skin cancer surgery, and then we have a whole second wing to the practice where we have a cosmetic wing. So I make people look younger and so I treat scars, I have lasers, I treat wrinkles, I treat, you know, age spots. And then we have a whole clinical research side of our practice. So I can do research, I can work with industry and drug development, and I'm able to do that as a single doctor, which in other specialties you really can't do. So after working with Kenny Green, he kind of showed me that, you know, how you can have this kind of, you could do a lot of different things in dermatology. That's how I found my way into derm. So it wasn't your classic route into a medical specialty.
So you touched on something I wanted to ask you about with research and pharmaceuticals. I get the sense it's just a rube that, you know, goes to my primary care once a year and, you know, like bothers guys like you with like text message and with pictures of, hey, what's this on my leg, you know? But like, I get the sense just from the outside looking in that there's kind of a love-hate relationship with pharmaceutical companies and kind of their relationship with doctors and sort of that balance of research and treatment and best for the patient, but everybody wants to succeed in all kind of facets. Could you go into that relationship a little bit? And is it complicated at all, or is it more straightforward than I'm making it out to be?
No, I mean, I think it's a little bit more complicated. I mean, I can kind of break it down. I mean, most doctors, if you're not involved on the kind of research side, their interaction with industry is, just make it simpler, say, you know, so I treat a lot of acne patients, and there's a lot of different drugs you can use for acne. A lot of, you know, there's like 50 creams you can use, and then there's oral pills, and there's different ones. And so a drug company will try to influence you or persuade you or show you data to prescribe their medication versus other competitor products. And so they're called drug reps. They'll come to your office, right, and they'll drop off, they, you know, may or may not, depending on the state regulations, they may drop off food, and they'll want to talk to you and give you a brochure and explain why their drug is better to the others. And it's frustrating as a physician sometimes, because that's our responsibility to understand the drugs that we're giving and why. And yet there's a 25-year-old who, you know, was a, you know, public policy major and is trying to tell me why his drug's better and explain to me the science behind it. So I see how some doctors can get frustrated from that kind of drug rep perspective, but they do a service. They can get you articles. If you're like, I haven't seen that publication, they'll pull them. And so they fill some role, but I think, you know, a lot of times they can be a nuisance, and they'll just pop in your office out of the blue. It's like, imagine you're like, they'll just show up and they'll expect to talk to you, and you have like, you're seeing patients, and it's, you know, it's not ideal. What I do is a little different, which I like, and I think it's critical what industry does, is, you know, if pharmaceutical companies couldn't make a profit, there would be no incentive for them to make new drugs, right? So, you know, the medicine wouldn't be pushed forward. And we can argue, and this is a whole huge argument about the public policy of the U.S. healthcare system, but the U.S. healthcare system from the pharmaceutical side is set up where drug companies can make a healthy profit if they make a good drug. And compared to other countries where drug prices are capped, you know, a lot of times they make the money in the U.S. and that the ability to generate profit spurs research and development.
Innovation, for new drugs, right?
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So you kind of need that. What I like is the idea of what are new drugs, how can, you know, and industry has to figure out what new drugs potentially be out there. So my relation, what I often do is I, you know, they call them kind of key opinion leaders, but I speak at conferences and I publish. And so companies will bring me in and be like, all right, we're thinking about this new drug for acne. You know, I'm giving examples of it. I'm not giving real life examples, but they'll be like, I'm thinking about bringing this new drug for dermatologists to solve this dermatologic issue. And I'll give my honest opinion because I'm not employed, but I'm like, yeah, that's a terrible idea. I would never prescribe that. Or that's actually very interesting. Yeah. You know, that could work. There's a niche here where, like, when I treat this, it never works. I don't have a good drug for this. If your drug actually has good data, I think that would be a home run. You'd do really well. So there's that consulting side where I'm brought in to think about, like, what are new drugs and help advise companies. Now, I'm not actually making those drugs, but I'm helping guide that. And then I can also be a part of the studies if these companies do say, all right, we have this drug, we want to do it, we think it would be a great idea. They have to do what's called a phase 3 clinical study, see if it gets approved, which I guess is very relevant right now. So you're hearing about all these vaccine studies. Uh-huh. So, you know, usually they call them phases of drug development. There's like a phase 1 where it's like, they give it to animals and be like, I hope it doesn't kill them. And they're like, all right, it doesn't kill them. And then they'll do what's called dose ranging, you know, so it's kind of safety. And then they do dose ranging. We're like, all right, it's safe. It, you know, it does what we think it does, but what is the right dose, we think? So they'll take a small number of human subjects and they'll dose them and they'll look at response, but they'll also get some safety ideas like, oh, wow, that higher dose patients got sick and maybe we should do this medium dose, because they have to pick the dose that then they say they're phase 3, which means like, all right, the safety looks pretty good. We have an idea what dose we think would work best. And now we're going to do a big study across multiple sites. So different offices in different locations of the world with different patient populations. So men and women, different ethnicities. And that big study is to determine if this drug is safe and effective. Is it, you know, so you look at the safety and efficacy. So like right now, that's what the vaccine studies are going through. They're going through mm-hmm. that phase 3. So I am a study site for many different sites who are doing the phase 3. So I'm one of the sites that gets to perform these research studies, which are very dictated. There's safety protocols and, you know, it's regulated, you know, it's monitored by the FDA. So that's another part of the practice. So I think industry is very important. I think there's aspects of it that can be improved and optimized. I think they're often vilified, and I think often there's good reasons for that. I think, you know, the pricing has been egregious. You know, companies have always made profits, but, you know, there's really no ability for insurance companies to negotiate prices, so drug companies can exponentially, indefinitely just continue to increase prices over time. So, like, price transparency, there's a lot of things, but I think industry serves an important role. And I think I work with it closely. I have a complicated issue, but I think they're good overall, but I think there's always room for improvement.
You mentioned the vaccine, and obviously we're recording this at the time still of COVID-19 and the pandemic, et cetera. Have you experienced with your practice, maybe, and are you concerned about this in general, folks may be afraid to go see their doctor. Folks may be afraid to go see Dr. Keeney because they're so afraid of the pandemic when there may be something way more serious at play here. And I'd love for you to speak to that. Obviously, you're not an epidemiologist, and that's not where your focus is. But I'm curious, as a doctor that deals with very serious issues in a wide range of them, is there something to that? And is that kind of a legitimate concern here for our citizenry as everyone's so afraid?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are, you know, patients who are taking this very seriously and are trying to minimize every truly unnecessary appointment or public outing. So there are, just to look at our numbers, we've opened, you know, we're in Virginia, right across the river, and we opened back up. We were allowed to open back up May 1st, but we opened up very slowly. And really around June 1st, we kind of opened up. And we've been running around 80% of patient volume since then compared to pre-coronavirus.
Okay.
So there's definitely a subset of patients who are not. And we just look at global numbers. So we know that 20%, you know, we're down 20%. So those are people choosing not to come in that were coming in, you know, prior to it. And the difference of those patients coming in is I think a lot more older patients are not coming in. So I think the at-risk patient population, which is right, they're even more reluctant to come into our office. Mm-hmm. But from a dermatology perspective, the older the patients are the ones at risk for skin cancer, non-melanoma skin cancer. So they're at the slightly higher risk threshold. Now, if they don't have risk factors for skin cancer, I mean, some stuff in dermatology can get pushed off. But I think if you look at data across medical specialties, there are, I've talked to my classmates from med school, you know, there are people have like put off cancer care and avoided, you know, they might've been having some, you know, shortness of breath, like when walking, and they're like, oh, I'll just deal with it later. And then they're going in later and they're getting diagnosed with heart disease and, mm-hmm. and lung disease later in the course. So I think there is that definite concern that people are delaying care because they want, you know, want to minimize risk. Cause it's interesting, you know, when during the peak of the pandemic, hospitals kind of eliminated all elective procedures, but emergency room visits went down rapidly. So there's a lot of people who are like, would have gone to the emergency room, were just sitting at home, you know? So they think that some of the death rate maybe contribute to people just avoiding medical care that they might have needed.
So for you and your practice, the thing that I was fascinated by when I was doing my research, just the variance, just the sheer volume of different things. You already touched on some of them, just at your practice, everything from research to, you know, cosmetic things to the cancer treatments and all the rashes and everything kind of in between. That's amazing to me. I sort of didn't really realize that and didn't really know it. And that's why I was kind of so interested to do this with you. Break down a percentage, kind of a pie chart informally with me about, you know, how much you're doing in terms of how many patients are you seeing for, you know, for skin cancers, biopsies, very serious things to, you know, kind of the more elective cosmetic things and everything in between. What's sort of the pie graph there?
Yeah. No, I mean, so I guess there's my practice. So, you know, around 3 years ago, I started Skinny C, which is a private practice in Arlington, Virginia, where the goal of our practice was to be kind of a full service dermatology, to create every aspect of that research, medical dermatology, and cosmetic dermatology. Now, as one provider, that's hard to do. So, you know, I have a partner and we have another, we have three dermatologists, actually a fourth is joining us in November. We have two physician assistants and we have estheticians. So we have a lot of people seeing patients in our practice. And so any given day in our practice, we're around to have 150 or so patients coming through our doors. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned before how, like, you know, you have to subspecialize so much in medicine. Well, you know, you still have to substitute, you know, so in my personal practice, what I do, I've kind of focused the things that I'm interested in, which is still a broad range. So I still see both medical and cosmetic dermatology. I'm probably 50-50 on that, you know, maybe 40% medical, 60% cosmetic. So on the medical side, I'm really particularly interested in hair disorders, so hair loss and other forms of hair loss, as well as acne and rosacea. Those are kind of my niches where I still see everything. I see rashes, but I see more of those. The other dermatologist in our practice is more the skin check, skin cancer kind of specialist. She has a passion for that, though. I see those in diagnosis, but that's kind of her niche. As an overall practice, we're probably 60% medical in terms of patient volume, 40% cosmetic. On the cosmetic side, you know, there's injectables like Botox and filler, which is to kind of restore facial volume. But we also treat like scars, and we do tattoo removal. Mm-hmm. We treat broken blood vessels. We treat vascular birthmarks on kids and adults. So, you know, it's not just like making lips big and getting rid of wrinkles. And we do other stuff. And it's interesting. I get to play with toys. We have all these lasers and the physics, and we freeze fat. We dissolve fat. We try to regrow hair. So, you know, there's a lot of different things we do on the cosmetic side. It's a little bit more tech heavy and technology, which interests me. So that, so the breakdown of our overall practice and my practice is a little different, but you know, our fundamental goal is to be able to have this full service. Cause I think a lot of even practices specialize. I'm a strictly medical or I'm a strictly cosmetic practice. We thought we wanted to kind of be the premier practice that takes care of every dermatologic issue you'd ever need to address.
I feel like women are just better at this than men. And it's, there's no stigma attached to it. They know how to take care of their skin, right? Whether it's moisturizer, whether it's the right, frilly smelling face wash and shampoo and things like that. I feel like men don't know anything. And I learned from your Facebook posts about just, you know, some of the things I should be buying. And it's kind of become a little bit more, I think, mainstream and accepted for men to practice better skincare. But what, A, is that kind of your experience? B, what should men know about taking care of their skin, specifically maybe face? And how do I get rid of the bags under my eyes? And why is my face so fat?
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I mean, if you look across the board, just at healthcare utilization, men are less likely to go to the doctor to be more proactive and preventative in terms of the health. And so that's part of the reason why they think some men have poor health outcomes across the board, not just dermatology. So men are have, you know, short life expectancy, and they think partly biology, but partly behavior. From a dermatology perspective, same thing. You know, men are more likely to get skin cancer. Men are more likely to die of melanoma. So these are much more common, and men are less likely to protect themselves from sun exposure, which is a known, thing that increases your chance of getting skin cancer and melanoma. I agree that, you know, men are just a little less savvy, but I think that's changed. And I think that's changed really with generations. I think younger people are becoming just more self-aware of what they look and how they look. And I think partly that's the rise of social media. You can't ignore seeing yourself in pictures and photos. And I mean, everyone has a camera on them all the time.
That's
so
right.
Even if even if you're not like single and taking selfies all the time, but you have kids, you're taking family photos, and then you're looking and you look at the photos, you're like, God, I might not look as great as I once was. You know, so I think men are becoming more, I call it cosmetically conscious, aware of their appearance. So I do think that's changed. And I think it's changed with kind of, not even like millennials, but even Gen X, you know, you're our age. And I mean, I think people, look, you know, we're a little bit more aware. I think men have different expectations. They're not trying to look perfect. Like some women are trying to kind of look flawless. I think men just don't want to age poorly. You know, sometimes they come in, they're like, I just don't want to look like my dad, you know? So what can men do? It's simple things. You know, there's really kind of three things your skincare. Like everyone focused on cleansers and moisturizers, but it's really use an antioxidant in the morning. So those are all those vitamin C serums. So there's good data about men may produce less antioxidants than women, and that's part of the reason why we might die younger. So topical antioxidant, one of those vitamin C serums you use in the morning. I tell my men that it's like, you know, patients, it's like your aftershave gel. You just throw it on after you shave. Then a sunscreen every day, even if it's cloudy, you still get 70% of UV light passes through clouds. So just make it a habit. So it's antioxidant in the morning and the sunscreen, and you're out the door. And then at night, the way to think about it is you got to correct the damage that was accumulated. So that's where the retinoids come in. Retinoids are vitamin A derivatives that have been shown to have a positive effect on skin. They can increase collagen production, and they kind of can maintain, I would say, kind of slow the aging process. A lot of retinoids on the market, but there's one prescription retinoid, because retinoids are also used for acne, that just went over the counter called Differin or Dapalene. So that's a good place to start for guys as well, if you don't want to get confused with all these like specialty items. But you do those three things, then you're like, I mean, you're way ahead of everyone else. So, and it's all about like kind of aging well. You know, men, we're all going to age, but we want to age well.
Yeah, I need to salvage something. It's I'm downhill with rocket skates at this point, dude. It's really, really bad. I got to fix it. Terrence,
Ahead. So it's the same way, but with fitness, you know, like yeah. I looked at you, Dan, and I was like, damn, he's kind of skinny. And so I was taking care of something, skin, but I wasn't taking care of my body, you know? So it's all part of that, like being healthier, you know, that kind of, and sometimes when you approach your late 30s, early 40s, it like hits you like a ton of bricks that you need to like start focusing a little bit more on that.
Yeah. I think of some of the ridiculous, like late night meals we did on sports trips, you know, or just snacking on stuff. And that's,
and you can handle it, and you can't handle it.
Right. But my metabolism has slowed down to an actual negative. I kept you long enough, my friend. Thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it, Terrence. Thanks, bud.
All right. Thank you, man.
Thank you to my guest, Dr. Terrence Keeney. His practice is Skin DC. So you can look that up very easily, just outside of Washington, D.C., located in Arlington, Virginia. Skin DC. They do everything, right, at his practice. And I thought this is the kind of thing that I think is very cool, and I'm very interested in. I love these sorts of deep dives. Not everybody does. I get that. But kind of my idea for doing this show, not just this one with Terrence, but this program in general, to do you seem interesting. The whole point was to me, let's say you were at a party. Remember parties, by the way? It's where like you were there with other people. And if you ask somebody, if you're just in conversation casually, what do? And if that person gives an answer and you go, oh, and you don't have any follow-ups, I wouldn't want that person on the show. But if you ask the question, you get an answer, and you immediately have a couple things that come to mind. Anything from, what do you think about this growth on my neck, to, you know, how many patients do you see during the pandemic times, or what's your relationship with pharma, and all some of the, you know, how many products are they pushing upon you, and what's the push pull with you, and some of the research elements that go on at your practice, etc. If you had follow up questions, you would want them on this show. Right. So next week, I'm talking to a wedding planner. I'm fascinated by some of that stuff. Right. I'm fascinated by what a special agent of the FBI does, or a lead attorney at the Department of Justice, or a political reporter, or somebody behind the scenes. Our guest last week, Dr. Arun Serafin at the Senate Armed Services Committee. How things work and some of their backgrounds that kind of go hidden are things that I'm always fascinated in. So thank you to Terrence for indulging some of my whims there when it comes to it. For his answers, obviously, just at the very end there. Skincare, taking care of yourself. He's right. It's just like anything else. The same way that dentists for years have tried to make teeth care and teeth cleaning part of your overall fitness and health regime, there's been a big push among dentistry to make sure that we understand that not only just brushing your teeth, but everything from flossing can help prevent certain diseases, help prevent infection, help prevent a lot of things that happen in and to our bodies. And that push, I think, has gone a long way as dentistry's come a million miles. Well, his point about skincare is just like anything else with physical fitness, right? Especially for folks like me, as we start to cross into different decades. That's a big deal. What I could do at 20, I simply cannot do at 40. That's reality. That's the human condition. And his point, I think was right on there. The other thing, I loved his answer about when it came to pharmaceuticals and medical practices. The reason I brought it up specifically was, think about the wide range. Again, we're talking about wide ranges. that a dermatologist would deal with, right? Everything from, you know, I'm going to butcher some of the names, bear with me. Anything from like oil of Olay to, you know, a nice lotion or something for your face to do anti-aging type creams. Everyone's trying to push the latest eucalyptus, the latest chemical, the latest, we got this plant from a mountainside in Fiji or whatever, right? Anything from that to, again, life-saving type treatments. That's everything under the sun, and I felt like dermatology would have that incredible relationship with pharma where you have to be very wary that people are trying to sell you stuff, but then efficacy is important, and that kind of balance, and I thought some of his points on that were really, really good and insightful, and it comes from the experience he has. I also didn't know they had this entire research component right there at his practice. I thought that was awesome. I think stuff like that is really neat, and I give credit to doctors that are continuing to evolve with time. I mean, we have this kind of romantic view of like the small town doc, you know, the guy that has seen everything 50,000 times, and you know, in the middle of the night, the parents bring their son with a tummy ache to him, and it's not an appendix, it's just some indigestion. Have him chew on this, and he does, and everything's fine. We have this romantic view of that, but the reality is these doctors have to pivot, have to evolve, have to continually update their files, and the best ones do that, right? And you could see for Dr. Terrence Keeney, his entire office and practice are almost intertwined with that, with the research elements and kind of keeping yourself up to date on the cutting edge, because something you prescribed 5 years ago may have been the best option at the time, but in 6 months, it's not. You got to keep yourself up to speed on that. And the doctors that are willing to do that, I think, always end up kind of coming out ahead and feeling very well. I also loved his answer, too, about his pathway. That's how a lot of us, I think, end up where we are, right? Where it's you think you want something, and the more you find out about it, maybe you want the offshoot or something slightly different. I can tell you right now, it happened to me. I didn't know I wanted to be on the radio specifically. I just knew that working in a regular office wasn't that much fun for me, and I wanted to try something else, and ended up and doing something that I really, really love. And so that's very relatable to me. And it's also relatable that you guys, this is a terrible transition. Oh, that was bad. Here's the point, though. Thanks for listening to the show. Really appreciate you guys checking this one out. This is a nerdy, deep dive into the world of dermatology. You made it. You stuck through it. You found the ending. I wish I had some kind of cool prize for you. All I got is a hearty thank you and the promise of another episode next week. So thanks you guys for checking out the show. Remember patreon.com/funnydanny. You want to support the show, you're more than welcome to listen on any platform. We're on Amazon now. We are there. You could search for You Seem Interesting on Amazon Podcasts. We're of course on Apple Pods, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of those fancy fun things. Thanks to my producer Andrew Russell, Kawanda Sound, KawandaSound.com as well. We'll be back next week with a brand spanking new episode. Until then, you guess you seem interesting.